places that they should, but it is a place of understanding and empathy you can operate from when you are feeling angry and frustrated. And finally, know your rights. When people hear this one, they automatically assume that it has a confrontational connotation, but it doesn't. Knowing your state's policies and procedures for how technology is procured, how services are determined, and what the appeals process is in the event that a decision is reached with which you disagree only helps you feel equipped. If you know what to expect, what should be on your individual plan for employment, or IPE, and how to justify the things you feel are necessary for your success, you will be able to stay calm when things get difficult. Respect yourself and your counselor enough to know your rights and responsibilities. Discuss these openly with your counselor, ask for them in writing, and ask questions when there's something you don't understand. This has the added benefit of equipping you with the knowledge you need in the unlikely event these tricks do not work and the relationship does not work out. In all likelihood, if you communicate, show kindness, and learn your rights, you'll establish a positive working relationship with your vocational rehabilitation counselor that will last you through your search for employment. These skills are transferable outside of this context as well. Knowing how to work with people that you don't necessarily like is valuable, and learning how to like people you previously did not appreciate is the true art of fly catching. And in a quick announcement from Future Reflections magazine, in the media, the Described and Captioned Media Program, or DCMP, and you can find them online at www.dcmasinmaryp.org. The DCMP supports families and educators with free remote learning resources. Families and educators who have at least one child or student with a disability can register for free membership and access over 8,000 captioned and described educational videos. Teachers can create student accounts, group students together, and assign videos to classes. Users can choose captioned or described with the language accessibility button found under the video player. Many videos are available without registering. DCMP is funded by the U.S. Department of Education and administered by the National Association of the Deaf. And that about wraps up this week's edition of the Blindness and Disability News Hour. This program covers the week of April 18th, 2021. Thanks for joining us. My name is Bill, and this program, as always, is a production of Mind's Eye Radio in Belleville, Illinois. Thanks for joining us again. Hope everyone has a good week. Stay warm as winter has reasserted itself for a few more days. Hopefully spring will return for good by next week. Till then, stay safe, stay in, take care of yourselves. See you next week.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Western Magazines, followed by the Noon Book Hour at 12.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 46 and mostly cloudy. Tonight it will be cloudy with a low in the upper 40s. Then tomorrow clear with a high in the upper 60s. Tomorrow night mostly cloudy with a low in the mid-50s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Produced at the Recording Library of West Texas. Your narrator is Jack.
Here are some articles from the February-March issue of Cowboys and Indians magazine. Best of the Big Screen West. Take 4 to celebrate films, filmmakers, and film stars of special interest to CNI readers. We're presenting the 4th annual edition of the CNI Movie Awards. Vote for your favorites at cowboysindians.com/movieawards by Joe Layden. Much like the organizers of most other movie awards during the year of COVID-19, we've had to make some adjustments to our voting process. Because we traditionally limit the list of qualified films to those that receive at least limited theatrical and or festival exposure, and to be honest, during 2020, some of that exposure was extremely limited, have 4 nominations in each category instead of the usual 5. On the other hand, we've added a brand new category this year, Best Documentary. That's where you'll find 4 exceptional nonfiction features that focus on the first wife of the legendary Johnny Cash, Matt Riddlehoover's My Darling Vivian, the creative processes of music, City, Tunesmith's It All Began with the Say Songs, the story of the Nashville songwriter, the challenging lives of contemporary cowboys, Bud Force and John Longmire's Cowboys, a documentary portrait, and the musical tastes of our 39th U.S. President, Murray Wharton's Jimmy Carter, Red and Rock and Roll President, which, despite its title, also includes testimonials from country artists like Willie Nelson, Larry Gatlin, and Garth Brooks. Of course, it wouldn't be a CNI Movie Awards celebration if our readers didn't have the final word in the selection process. So we're asking you to visit cowboysandindians.com and cast your vote for your favorite in each category. We're also seeking your nominations for the greatest Western film of all time. You'll be able to write in your all-time favorite, and we'll be revealing an updated ranking of classic Westerns later this year. The deadline for submitting your picks in the CNI Movie Awards will be Wednesday, March 3rd. Winners will be announced Friday, March 5th. Vote at cowboysindians.com/movieawards. Vote now. Among the dramatic features with multiple nominations are five movies. First Cow, a critically acclaimed period drama from Mex Cutoff director Kelly Reichardt about 2 improbably matched partners who hit upon a novel way to milk opportunities and make their fortune in the 19th century Oregon Territory. Let Him Go. CNI reader faves Kevin Costner and Diane Lane star to perfection in Thomas Bazooka's slow burn thriller as a Montana couple driven to extremes while trying to retrieve their grandchild from an off-the-grid clan in the Dakotas. News of the World. Tom Hanks reunites with Captain Phillips director Paul Greengrass for the Oscar-winning actor's first Western, the story of a Civil War veteran who signs on to return a youngster, Helena Zingle, raised by Kiowa to her biological family. Nomadland, for her follow-up to The Rider, director Chloe Zhao offers another masterful entwining of fact and fiction while focusing on a strong-willed woman, 2-time Oscar winner Frances McDormand, who packs her van and begins a nomadic life in the American West. And Yellow Rose, a Filipina teen, Eva Nobolzada, in Bastrop, Texas, develops a taste and talent for country music and winds up being mentored by veteran country artist Dale Watson, played in a bold stroke of casting by Dale Watson in Diane Parraga's contemporary drama. Here are the nominees. Best Picture, First Cow, Let Him Go, News of the World, Nomadland. Best Director, Thomas Bazooka, Let Him Go, Paul Greengrass, News of the World, Kelly Reichardt, First Cow, Chloe Zhao, Nomadland. Best Actor, Kevin Costner, Let Him Go, Tom Hanks, News of the World, Harrison Ford, The Call of the Wild, John Magaro, First Cow. Best Actress, Eva Nobelzada, Yellow Rose, Diane Lane, Let Him Go, Frances McDormand, Nomadland, Helen Zinga, News of the World, Best Supporting Actor, Gary Farmer, First Cow. Orion Lee, First Cow. David Strathairn, Nomadland. Dale Watson, Yellow Rose. Best Supporting Actress, Kaylee Carter, Let Him Go. Leslie Manville, Let Him Go. Linda May, Nomadland. Princess Punzalan, Yellow Rose. Best Screenplay, Thomas Basuka, Let Him Go. Paul Greengrass and Luke Davies, News of the World. Kelly Reichardt and Jonathan Raymond, First Cow. Chloe Zhao, Nomadland. And Best Documentary, Cowboys, A Documentary Portrait. It All Begins with a Song, the story of the Nashville songwriter. Jimmy Carter, Rock and Roll President. And finally, My Darling Vivian. Home Sweet Stockyards. Hotel Drover is the crown jewel in a host of new developments to Mule Alley in Fort Worth's most beloved and historic area. By Hunter Hawk. Livestock business, tourism, live entertainment, and nightlife have made Fort Worth's historic stockyards a premier Western destination for generations. The area that began in earnest as a crucial livestock shipping point during the late 1800s has evolved into a bustling, walkable destination, still functional for the industry at large, but now the number one source of endless fun and hospitality for Cowtown's visitors. The history is rich, and it's honored in every corner of the stockyards, from the musical lore of large and legendary Billy Bob's Texas to the lasting beauty of the Grand Livestock Exchange Building, with interest points and must-visit entities all along the way. So, any new development there has to be done with sensitivity and with respect to what came before. The newest round of additions and developments to the stockyards, one of the most significant the area has ever seen, indeed arose from concerns for both the past and the future. Most of the last decade had been devoted to the development overseen by Craig Cavalier, Executive Vice President of Majestic Realty Company and Stockyards Heritage Development Company. Cavalier, a fourth-generation Texan, was brought in by longtime Stockyards investor Holt Hickman before Hickman's 2014 passing to breathe new life into a part of the neighborhood that had housed iconic horse and mule barns for more than 100 years. Hickman was transferring responsibility to his son and daughter, and we were going through second-generation transitions with the different owners in the stockyards, Cavalier says. Throughout the stockyards, the second generation of family was taking things over, so there was an opportunity to come in and try to do some consolidation and real master planning around what could be the next chapter. We really wanted it to respect not just the stockyards, but the American West and the storytelling of the early Texan settlers and the grit and determination that they had in setting up the frontier. And then, of course, there were the great cattle drives in the mid to late 1800s, the Chisholm Trail, and the role that the stockyards played in the evolution of the cattle industry. The result of the involvement of Cavalier and the creation of the Stockyards Heritage Development Company has started to see light of day over the last several months after years of planning and development. New eateries such as the Biscuit Bar and Chef Marcus Pesley's Provender Hall and iconic storefronts from the likes of Lucchese, Wrangler, and King Ranch Saddle Shop are now in place. The crown jewel of the development, expected to open to the public in February, is Hotel Drover, a decidedly Western 200-room luxury lodge designed to be the central point of all activity in the stockyard's new iteration of Mule Alley. Originally planned for a 2020 open, Hotel Drover's developers found they needed a little more time for build-out during the first stages of the worldwide pandemic. it was not a bad idea to push it back a little for us anyway, because it just takes time to build one of these four-star hotels, Cavalier says. These things have got a lot of exterior landscaping and fire pits and pools and outdoor areas. It just takes time to get done. So February would be just right for us on that one. Honestly, other than the Hotel Emma and a handful of others around the state, there's nothing that will rival the unique experience of Hotel Drover. A hard hat tour toward the end of the summer confirmed that Cavalier isn't exaggerating. The rustic, homey front of the complex seems designed to make visitors feel welcome, but they'll be taken aback when they step inside to see the grand bar and lobby area with its warm stone and wood textures. The design scheme extends to the rooms, suites, and eatery, 97 West Kitchen and Bar, retail spaces including La Casey Custom Boot Shop, and more than 12,000 square feet of available meeting space for groups and conferences. The name of the hotel itself is inspired by the Drovers, whose last stop on their cattle drives was often Fort Worth. The hotel's marketing materials cite the attention to history well. Returning to the stockyards after months on the open plains brought familiarity, comfort, and the feeling of coming home.
Hello, this is Michael, and I'll be reading an article from True West magazine. Last week, we read from April 1991's magazine an article called Toughest Cow Outfit in Texas, Part 1. This week, we go to the May 1991 edition of True West for Toughest Cow Outfit in Texas, Part 2, by R.K. DeArmet. Editor's note, last month, the Millet Brothers Ranch in North Texas was known as one of the toughest spots this side of hell, and its owners were said to hire only the meanest cowboys. The gunfights and killings they were associated with seemed to prove that notion true. Main text. No doubt the most notorious of the gunfighting Millet hands was a man known at various times and places as James Daniels or James D. Sherman, but best remembered by the name that was his go-by in Kansas, Jim Talbot. A native of DeKalb County, Missouri, Talbot was described in a wanted circular as well-built, with light complexion and blonde hair and whiskers. Pale gray-blue eyes were set in a broad, high cheekbone face with a low, narrow forehead and an upturned nose. An unusually long jaw caused his lower teeth to project out over the upper ones. He generally gambles and carouses around saloons, said the notice. He is wanted in several places for horse stealing and shooting men, is a bad outlaw. There were newspaper reports that the man's real name was James Sherman Talbot, that his mother's name was Sherman, and that he was related to General William T. Sherman. W.B. Bat Masterson, in an article on Western gunfighters he had known, probably had this fellow in mind when he wrote of Johnny Sherman, a well-known Western sport and a near relative of the famous Sherman family of Ohio, who practiced in shooting galleries by the hour and was a remarkably fine pistol shot. Masterson said that Sherman was courageous as a lion, but that he emptied his pistol at a dentist in a St. Louis hotel room without as much as puncturing his clothes, because in his rage at the man who had insulted his wife, he forgot that there was a set of sights on his pistol. Talbot, or Sherman, was known as Jim Daniels when he rode for the Millets in 1881. He was a gunman, right, and was wanted by the law at Albany, Texas, for killing a man down in some southern county, said A.P. Black. He went into the Millet Ranch office one day and drew his wages, and when he stepped out the door, a sheriff and two deputies stood waiting with papers for his arrest. They knew they could never take him alive, so Simpson, the sheriff, let fly with a double load of buckshot. Talbert jumped back and commenced shooting at their vest, buttons with his six-shooter. Simpson got a bunch of lead in his belly and toppled off his horse. One of the deputies had his gun shot out of his hand, and the other deputy headed for the Mesquite. Talbert got clean away and never showed up until fall, when he left for Smoky River with the beef herd. This shooting affair at the ranch house occurred in February 1881 and has been described with less color, but perhaps more accuracy, by Henry Herron, one of the officers involved. A deputy sheriff named Perry had been trailing Jim Daniels, alias Talbert, alias Sherman, and several other Millet riders from Hill County, where they were wanted for horse theft. At Albany, Perry enlisted the aid of Shackelford County Sheriff Green Simpson and Deputy Sheriff Herron. A man named A.B. Duty, whose saddle had been stolen by one of the fugitives earlier, also accompanied the lawman to the Millet spread. As we neared the ranch house, we saw four men holding a herd about a half mile away, recalled Herron. We figured these were our men, so we dropped down a ravine. Sheriff Simpson headed for the ranch house to get help, but the fugitives spotted him and took off after him at a gallop. Simpson reached the ranch house, grabbed a shotgun inside, and stepping to the doorway, started shooting. The fugitives had dismounted and were scurrying behind the rock wall surrounding the buildings. Simpson's shotgun, said Herron, happened to be loaded with birdshot. He hit his man, Daniels, in the legs, but did not bring him down. I saw Simpson fall back in the doorway. He was shot through both arms with a Winchester bullet. We had only six shooters and were too far away for pistol shooting, but started shooting as we advanced. I emptied my pistol before they brought me down with a Winchester bullet through my right hip. My horse was shot first, hit in the forehead, and we both started falling at the same time. Their first shot at Perry hit the cylinder of his pistol and put it out of action, although he stood his ground and tried to get his gun going. They killed his horse and shot him five times in various parts of his body, none being fatal. Duty claimed to have been shot in the cheek, but he could not stand under fire and pulled his freight, and did not stop until he reached Young County. Although the four thieves were supposed to have been the only one shooting at us, it has always been my opinion that they had help from inside the house, as I saw puffs of smoke from an inside window. After Perry and I were down and helpless, one of them, Daniels, came out and asked me if I had any money. I told him I was broke, so he said, "I'll just fix you so you will not follow me anymore." John Simpson of Dallas was there at the time receiving cattle. He came out with Daniels and persuaded him not to kill me, saying that I was crippled up and wouldn't be able to follow him again. I said nothing, knowing that there was no use. But John Simpson, no doubt, saved my life. Herron said that he was told Daniels had murdered a man and a woman before coming to the Millets. It was his recollection that soon after this affray, all four of the outlaws were killed, three in Indian Territory and the other in Colorado. But James Daniels, at least, survived for a number of years and had yet to participate in his most notable exploit. He was indicted at the next session of the Baylor County Grand Jury for assault with intent to murder the law officers. And 19 years later, he was still on the Texas list of fugitives from justice. A month after the gunfight at the Millet Ranch House, he showed up in Caldwell, Kansas, now using the name Jim Talbert, and was arrested during a drunken debauch by Mike Meager, a noted Cowtown peace officer. Back in Baylor County in the fall, he took part in the last northern cattle drive from the Millet Ranch. The brothers had sold out their holdings to W.E. Hughes and John N. Simpson, owners of the Hash Knife Ranch at Buffalo Gap. Simpson, the same man who saved Deputy Sheriff Herron's life, had been at the ranch negotiating the sale at the time. Simpson purchased the ranch and some 8,000 cows and any calves trailing with them. When he arrived at the Millet headquarters with his own crew on a particularly cold day, he found all the blankets gone, stolen by the departed Millet cowboys, and almost had an insurrection on his hands. Among those riding with Talbert on that last drive were John Cook, Bob Bigtree, Dick Edelman, Doug Hill, Tom Love, Jim Martin, and Bob Munson. Foreman of the crew was Cook, whose maiden name was Crusaw Baird, and who, according to A.P. Black, was wanted along with Talbert for killing a man somewhere. "He was a real cowman if I ever saw one," said Black, but so damn tough he could hardly sleep with himself. After delivery of the herd at Caldwell in November, Talbot stayed on. Outlawed, now in Texas, with officers from at least three counties on the watch for him, he set about making a permanent camp in the booming cattle town. He sent for his wife and two small children and moved into a house on Chisholm Street. Former Millet cowpunchers Big Tree, Edelman, Hill, Love, Martin, and Munson also remained to help him whoop it up in the town, now billing itself as the Queen of the Border. Early in December 1881, a Caldwell banker named J.S. Danford closed his bank and slipped quietly out of town. What happened then has been told best in the salty language of Oliver Nelson, a cowboy who was in town at the time. The depositors held a consult, said Nelson, and offered a reward of 25 plunks to the man who would bring the absconding banker back. The proposition was accepted by a peeler named Jim Talbot, who had rolled in a short time before and was engaged in exchanging kale for a good time. After Talbot brought Danford back at the point of a gun, one mourner said he'd give $25 to anyone that would shoot him. Talbot pointed his .45 fully cocked and said, "Out with your money." But the fellow backed down. Then Jim said, "I'll send him out for $20, but no one would hand over that much. Not surprisingly, Danford would get shaky during these discussions. The papers reported that the banker was almost lynched, but eventually he made a settlement with his depositors and gratefully got out of Caldwell with his hide intact. Only a few days later, Talbot and his pals were principals in an eruption of violence that prompted a Wichita paper to announce on December 17th, "As we go to press, hell is in session at Caldwell." It was said later that the basis for this trouble was a grudge Talbot held against Mike Meager, a 38-year-old Irishman, who, before coming to Caldwell, had distinguished himself as a city marshal and a deputy United States marshal at Wichita during its wildest cattle town days. In Caldwell, Meager operated a saloon and gambling establishment, but found time to serve a term as mayor of the town. As an experienced cowtown lawman, he was often called upon to assist the Caldwell officers in handling rambunctious cowboys. Some reports had it that Talbot was gunning for Meager because a man named Sylvester Powell, that Meager had killed back in Wichita, was a cousin of Talbot's, and the Texas gunman sought revenge. There was another rumor that Talbot was a half-brother to George Flapp, a city marshal of Caldwell who had been killed mysteriously the previous year. According to this theory, Mike Meager had been responsible for Flapp's death, and Talbot was balancing the books. There was also a story that Talbot was still angry over his arrest by Meager the previous March, and another that the trouble started when Meager ejected Talbot from his saloon, and the cowboy vowed that he would burn powder in Meager's face for that. On the night of December 16th, the play Uncle Tom's Cabin opened in Caldwell. Jim Talbot, his friends, and what a local paper called their prostitutes were on hand and became so loud and obscene as to disturb the whole house. The following morning, Talbot and his cowboy pals, joined by local sports George Spear and Comanche Bill Mankin, resumed their revelry and began firing their pistols in the streets. City Marshal John Wilson enlisted the aid of several Caldwell citizens, including Mike Meager, to bring the troublemakers under control. A series of skirmishes followed throughout the day, culminating finally in a general gun battle in which Mike Meager and George Spear were killed. Jim Talbot is credited in all accounts with Mike Meager's death. Surprisingly, George D. Freeman, a resident of Caldwell and witness to the fight, who later was a member of the posse pursuing the cowboys, expressed his admiration for Talbot's courage during the battle. "Jim Talbot has never been equaled by the bravery and the daring which he portrayed," said Freeman. "He stood bravely to the front with revolver in each hand, firing at the men he had premeditated to kill. Shots fired by the citizens were striking the buildings and tearing up the ground in all directions near the fearless leader who stood undaunted by shot or bullet, watching for the men who were to be his victims. When Talbot had emptied his six shooters, he called to his men and said, "Boys, let's get our Winchesters," and started on the run for his house, followed by his gang of outlaws. Writing only 8 years after the Caldwell battle, Freeman depicted Talbot as a bold and fearless man and a desperado who recognized cowardice as a crime, had an indomitable will, and spilled blood of his fellow men freely and without reluctance or care. In the bloody affray, he asked no quarter, he would give none. His heart was filled with bitterness and hatred and the brooding of revenge. Such was the character of the courageous and fearless Jim Talbot. Another battle erupted as the cowboys tried to secure horses to escape from town. Dick Edelman and Tom Love never got mounted and were later arrested. Talbot led his remaining followers on a run for the nearby border of Indian Territory, closely pursued by several posses. Another gun battle with posse men took place later that day, but the desperados managed to escape during the night. Rewards totaling $1,100 were posted for their capture. The gunfight at Caldwell filled the pages of newspapers throughout Kansas, and a month later, on January 12, 1882, the fugitives gave their version of the incident in a remarkable letter to the Kansas City Times, saying that they had been basely misrepresented as cutthroats. Talbot and company denied that they were drunk at the time of the fight or had just ridden in to hurrah the town, as some papers stated. "We had been in town about 1 month and had always abided by its laws," said the letter. The cowboys contended that Mike Meager, who had two six-shooters in his hands at the time he was shot, was not the upstanding citizen he had been portrayed in the press, but was nothing more than a saloon keeper who ran a keno table. They denied the story that the earlier killing of George Flatt precipitated the trouble. "It never entered our minds," said the outlaws, who blamed the outbreak on harassment by City Marshal John Wilson, who was on a protracted drunk. Wilson proceeded to organize a mob to take or kill us and turned to shoot one of the boys in the back, and this is why the row came up. We went out and got our guns and marched to the front and engaged in a fight, which lasted about an hour. We then went and got our horses and started to leave town, and then we were fired on from every and all concealed place imaginable. The second skirmish lasted about 30 minutes, and then we were forced to ride. This is the true facts of the row." The letter, also branded as a bare falsehood, a report circulated in Caldwell that Talbot was a member of the Billy the Kid gang, saying that Talbot has never seen Kid and has never had any acquaintance with him whatsoever. The letter closed by saying that the riders were willing to stand trial if they thought they could get justice, but this they knew they could not get. It was signed by Jim Talbot, Doug Hill, Bob Munson, Jim Martin, and Bob Bigtree. The fugitives were hiding out at this time in the breaks along the Red River, not far from the trail crossing at Doan's store. Bob Munson would appear at night at his pal Carvin Doan's house and order supplies, which Doan would get for him at the store. Munson said he had ridden 120 miles bareback in the escape and couldn't sit down for a week. Texas Ranger Captain Arrington was in the area hunting the Caldwell fugitives and suspected Doan knew their whereabouts. "He offered $1,000 to me if I would tell him where they were," Doan said later. "I knew, but I had my wife and baby and my uncle's two daughters, and I couldn't afford to tell them, and told Arrington so. He said I was right. They would have killed me." On January 24, 1882, at a preliminary hearing in Wellington, Kansas, Tom Love was acquitted of complicity in the death of Mike Meager. 4 days later, Dick Edelman escaped from the Sumner County Jail, but was quickly reapprehended. "Edelman will probably get about 7 years for breaking jail and stealing a horse," said the Caldwell Post, adding, "This will be rather rough on the boy if he could have escaped the charge of participating in the Talbot riot." Doug Hill, arrested and charged with the murder of Meager in 1887, copped a plea of fourth-degree manslaughter and served 6 months in the county jail.
It was 12 years before Jim Talbot was returned to Caldwell to answer the murder charge against him. Outlawed in Kansas as well as Texas after the Caldwell battle, he moved to California, where he worked cattle under the name of James D. Sherman, and by 1889 was foreman of the Marks and Newfield Ranch in Mendocino County. But the propensity to spill blood without reluctance or care that G.D. Freeman recognized back in Caldwell resurfaced, and Talbot killed again in a drunken debate with a Ukiah jeweler over the importance of the fast draw in a gunfight. Talbot suddenly jerked his pistol and shot the jeweler dead. This killing set off an extended series of legal problems which plagued Talbot the rest of his life. He was at first cleared on a self-defense plea before a coroner's jury, but later tried, convicted, and sentenced to San Quentin. His lawyers appealed, and the case went to the California Supreme Court, and he won a new trial. He was awaiting a second trial when Kansas authorities brought him back to face a charge of murder in Meagher's killing. A trial in April 1895 ended in a hung jury. Retired later in the year, he was acquitted. As pointed out by a contemporary paper, Meagher was killed in an affray which was little short of a pitched battle between the citizens of Caldwell and the cowboys, and the difficulty of fixing the responsibility for the firing of the fatal shot has been greatly increased by the lapse of time. Talbot went back to California to find that his wife had run off with a man named Bryce Vallele. Talbot hunted the pair down and brought his wife back. In August 1896, he was returning to his home from a trip to Covelo when he was shot from ambush by a hidden assassin. Vallele was suspected, but over the years, the man known as Daniels, Talbot, and Sherman had given many men ample cause to wish him dead. His murderer was never apprehended. The Millet Brothers Ranch on the Brazos, which had harbored a remarkable string of violent and desperate cowboys, had long since passed into history. Lon Millet, who later established a ranch in the San Juan Valley of Colorado, was thrown from a horse there and died from his injuries. High Millet, according to A.P. Black, was killed in a poker game in Kansas City. Only Old Cap, the eldest of the brothers, passed away quietly in bed. True West, April 2021. A Long Shot, Buffalo Hunters versus Quanah Parker's Warrior, by Bob Bozbell. The Second Battle of Adobe Walls features the legendary 1,530-foot yard shot heard round campfires ever since, June 27, 1874. The Comanches and their Kiowa, Southern Cheyenne, and Arapaho allies are hell-bent on driving buffalo hunters off their land. The hunters have already decimated the herds on the northern plains. Now these hunters have set up shop near Adobe Walls, deep in Comanche territory in the Texas Panhandle. A force of up to several hundred warriors, led by a messiah-like medicine man named Isai Tai and by Comanche chief Quanah Parker, advance at daybreak on the settlement. The attackers are counting on the element of surprise, but when they charge at dawn, they discover most of the hunters are awake, repairing a broken ridge pole. The defenders, 28 men and one woman, repel the initial charge with the loss of only two men who were asleep in the wagon. The first wave almost carries the day as the attackers are close enough to pound on the doors and windows with their rifle butts. At such close range, the defenders are not able to use their superior firepower and end up fighting with pistols and lever-action rifles. After repulsing the initial attack, the buffalo hunters hold back the attackers with their long-range Sharps rifles. 20-year-old Bat Masterson carries one, as does sharpshooter Billy Dixon. 30-plus long-range Sharps are quickly deployed to defend the camp. The 15 attackers they kill are scattered so close to the buildings that the Indians cannot retrieve their comrades' bodies. By noon, the Indians take up positions around the besieged hunters, maintaining a steady barrage of fire into the buildings. By 2 p.m., the attackers retreat beyond rifle range to reconnoitre. By 4 p.m., the hunters are able to leave the buildings. they retrieve weapons from the dead and bury their bodies. On the second day, the defenders drag away the dead horses and oxen. The attackers have killed all 28 belonging to the Schaedler brothers. To prevent the evil smell from reaching the buildings, Dixon recalls in his autobiography. During a lull in the fighting, several hunters arrive at adobe walls, increasing the number of defenders to more than 30 men. Hunter Henry Leese volunteers to ride to Dodge City, Kansas, to seek out further reinforcements. On the third day, 15 Indian warriors ride out on a bluff nearly a mile away to survey the situation. At the behest of one of the hunters, William Billy Dixon, a crack shot, takes aim with a borrowed 50-90 Big 50 Sharps rifle. After calculating the drop in the wind factor, he fires and cleanly drops a warrior from atop his horse. Dixon later says, "I was admittedly a good marksman, yet this was might be called a scratch shot." Tradition claims Dixon's shot so discourages the Indians that they decamp and give up the fight. Quanah's headlong charge. There was never a more splendidly barbaric sight. In after years, I was glad that I had seen it. Hundreds of warriors, the flower of the fighting men of the southwestern plains tribes, mounted upon their finest horses, armed with guns and lances, and carrying heavy shields of thick buffalo hide, were coming like the wind. Over all was splashed the rich colors of red, vermilion, and ochre on the bodies of the men, on the bodies of the running horses. Scalps dangled from bridles. Gorgeous war bonnets fluttered their plumes. Bright feathers dangled from the tails and manes of the horses, and the bronzed, half-naked bodies of the riders glittered with ornaments of silver and brass. Behind this headlong charging host stretched the plains, on whose horizon the rising sun was lifting its morning fires. The warriors seemed to emerge from this glowing background. Signed, Billy Dixon. The Sharpshooter. Originally from Henryville, Quebec, Canada, Bat Masterson, 20, is the youngest of the 28 buffalo hunters at Adobe Walls. Masterson serves as a civilian scout during the Red River War of 1874 to 75. A shooting on January 24, 1876 in Sweetwater, now Mobetie, Texas, becomes the basis for his gunfighter reputation. Bad Medicine. In the spring of 1874, medicine man Isatai, translates as wolf's vulva or coyote vagina, began claiming he had true Puja, Comanche for power, and that anyone who followed him would be immune to the white man's bullets. On May 26, 1874, Quanah Parker massed his fighters on a high bluff next to the Canadian River. Isatai appeared before the assembled warriors naked, except for a cap of sage stems. His body was painted yellow, as was his horse's body, representing invulnerability. Many of the other braves had painted their bodies yellow as well to demonstrate their own beliefs in Isatai's Puja and that a moment of destiny had arrived to bring them their redemption. When they lose the battle in June, many of the warriors are understandably upset with Isatai. One of the Cheyenne men strikes the medicine man in the face with a riding quirt. Another, the father of a young warrior who was killed, demands that, since Isatai is immune to the white man's bullets, he should go down and retrieve his son's body. Before Isatai responds, one of the Big 50s reaches the group, knocking the rider next to him out of the saddle, while another Sharp's bullet kills Isatai's horse. Isatai gives an excuse for the debacle, blaming the Cheyenne's killing of a skunk the day before the battle as jinxing his medicine. Nobody believes him. In spite of Isatai's bad medicine, he continues on his merry way, spreading his false gospel. The Big 50. To make his long shot, Billy Dixon fires a single-shot 50-90 Sharps rifle. These guns are so powerful, they can put down a 2,000-pound buffalo at 1,000 yards. An examination of the shot. Although Dixon himself claimed that it was a scratch shot, many modern shooters try to debunk the shot he made with the borrowed 50-90 Sharps. In the fall of 1992, friend and fellow gun writer Mike Vetturino was invited along with Shiloh Sharps owners to travel to the Yuma Proving Grounds in Arizona to use some then newly declassified radar devices to test the performance of several types of ammunition. Using a machine rest modified from a gun carrier from a Russian T-72 tank, they started firing away. For the first sharp shot, with the gun carriage elevated to 35 degrees, a 675 grain bullet pushed by 90 grains of FFG black powder and with a muzzle velocity, MV, of only 1,216 feet per second, FPS, launched the bullet over 3,600 yards distance. That's 10,800 feet, over 2 miles. The scientists couldn't believe it, so a second round was touched off. This time, the lead projectile weighed 650 grains with an MV of 1,301 FPS. Using the same 35-degree elevation, the bullet landed 3,245 yards away. After one of the mathematicians calculated the data, he suggested they reduce the elevation to about 4.5 to 5 degrees to duplicate Billy Dixon's shot. When this was done using the same load, the lead slug landed 1,517 yards downrange, almost the exact range of Dixon's controversial shot. A 5-degree muzzle elevation can easily be reached with only the rear barrel sight on a Shiloh Sharps. Phil Spachenberger writing. Quanah Parker's version of the fight. "We at once surrounded the place and began to fire on it," recalled Quanah Parker. "The hunters got in the houses and shot through the cracks and holes in the wall. Fight lasted about 2 hours. We tried to storm the place several times, but the hunters shot so well we would have to retreat. At one time, I picked up 5 braves, and we crawled along a little ravine to their corral, which was only a few yards from the house. Then we picked our chance and made a run for the house before they could shoot us, and we tried to break the door in, but it was too strong. And being afraid to stay long, we went back the way we had come." From adobe walls to Quigley Down Under. According to a published 1887 government survey, the Sharps was the most used rifle by professional hide hunters. Over a century later on the silver screen, filmdom's Matthew Quigley's 1874 Shiloh Sharps quickly earned the respect of the movie's Australian stockmen when he made his supposedly 1,200-yard bucket shot. In real life, when buffalo hunter Billy Dixon dropped an Indian warrior from 1,538 yards with a borrowed Big 50 Sharps at the Second Battle of Adobe Walls, it caused the warriors to withdraw from the fight. One could say that this was the Old West's shot heard around the world. It not only ended the Indians' attack on the small settlement, but the Sharps cemented a lasting respect with riflemen of all kinds. Frontiersmen held a healthy respect for anyone armed with the Sharps, forever known as among the most powerful and accurate long-range arms in the West. It's no wonder the Indians dubbed the 1874 Sharps as the Shoots Far Rifle, or the Shoot Today, Kill Tomorrow Gun. Phil Spachenberger, True West's firearms editor. Aftermath, odds and ends. As news of the Adobe Walls fight spread, more hunters came in for protection and to help defend the settlement. By the sixth day, the garrison grew to about 100 men. Quanah Parker was wounded in one of the attacks, and some believe this is why the Indians retired without more of a fight. The Indians probably came to the conclusion that if they remained long enough, charged often enough, and got close enough, all of them would be killed, as they were unable to dislodge us from the buildings, one of the hunters said. Casualty reports vary. Today, most historians agreed that fewer than 30 died during the battle. By August, Lieutenant Frank D. Baldwin, with Billy Dixon and Bat Masterson as scouts, arrived at Adobe Wells, where a dozen men were still holed up. The next day, the soldiers and remaining men left Adobe Wells, heading south to join General Nelson A. Miles' main command on Containment Creek. The Indians later burned the place to the ground. The Adobe Walls fight led to the Red River War of 1874 and 75, which resulted in the final relocation of the Southern Plains Indians to the reservations in what is now Oklahoma. True West Magazine, May 2021. Fighting Irps, Rattlesnakes, and the Birds and the Bees by Marshall Trimble. Question: did any of the fighting Irps have children? Warren Rutherford, Phoenix, Arizona. Nicholas Earp and his first wife, Abigail Storm, had two children. One was a son they named Newton. Abigail died when Newton was only two. Newton's sister, Mariah Ann, passed 2 months after his mother at the tender age of 10 months. Nicholas's second wife, Virginia Jenny, bore him 8 children, including 5 boys, James, Virgil, Wyatt, Morgan, and Warren. Of Nicholas and Jenny's 5 boys, only Virgil fathered a child, a girl. Newton fathered 2 boys, Virgil and Wyatt, naming them after 2 of his younger half-brothers. All the Earp brothers, including Newton, were close. In the second True Grit movie, there is a scene where they are bedding down for the night. It appears Rooster puts a rope on the ground around Maddie's bed. Why? Greg Williams, Apache Junction, Arizona. There was an old superstition that a rattlesnake wouldn't cross over a rope, so cowboys used to string one around their bedrolls to keep the snakes away. I had a chance to witness a test of whether or not a snake would be thwarted by a rope. It wasn't. How did Old West figures take care of their guns? Vance Johnson, Fillmore, California. It depended on how much they might need their revolver in a life or death situation. Men like Wild Bill Hickok, Billy the Kid, or Jesse James might clean and oil their pistol every day because their lives might depend on it at any given moment. Black powder was dirty, and you didn't want a malfunction at a critical moment. A cowhand who had different and more infrequent gun needs might clean it once a month or so. My friends and I were having a discussion about parents having sex in those one-room cabins on the frontier. I said, "Let's ask the marshal." They said, "He won't answer that one." So we made a bet. I said, "You would." Brenda Wade, San Diego, California. Brenda, you win. There are many ways to answer your question. I could simply say they did it quietly, or they waited until the kids fell asleep. Living in such cramped quarters, modesty was difficult, if not impossible. Kids figured out at a young age how babies were made and where they came from. Oftentimes, the older children assisted their mother in giving birth. Add in the fact that kids grew up around livestock and saw animals in the act of mating and giving birth. In reality, couples just did what comes naturally. Then someone comes along in the 20th century and invented privacy, along with homes featuring separate bedrooms. How were elections run in the Wild West? Jonathan Waller, Hampshire, UK. For the first 50 years of American elections, most voting wasn't done in private, and voters didn't even make their choice on a paper ballot. Instead, those with the right to vote, only white men at the time, went to the local courthouse and publicly cast their vote out loud. Campaigning and carousing were allowed at the polling place, and candidates often provided whiskey to prospective voters, which might explain why turnout rates were around 85%. The first paper ballots began appearing in the early 19th century, but they weren't standardized or even printed by government elections officials. By the mid-19th century, state Republican or Democratic Party officials would distribute pre-printed flyers to voters listing only their party's candidates for office. They were called tickets because the small rectangles of paper resembled 19th century train tickets. Irregularities at the polls were common. In the Pima County Sheriff election of 1880, Republican Bob Paul was running against Democrat Charlie Schibel. Hall had a good reputation as a tough lawman, while Schibel was more of an administrator. Cowboys like Clanton and Johnny Ringo managed to get themselves named elected officials. With only 50 eligible voters in the San Simon district, Schibel received 123 votes, and Paul only got one. Paul lost the election, but an investigation later declared him the winner. And now here are more questions that were asked of columnist Marshall Trimble. These were published in the July 2013 edition of True West magazine. When were photos first put on wanted posters? B.R. Fleener, Springfield, Tennessee. In the classic era of the Old West, 1870s and 1880s, most reward posters were just handbills or postcards sent to law enforcement officials with printed descriptions of the wanted men. No photos, although an exception was made in the case of the assassins of President Abraham Lincoln. The idea of photos on reward posters came around the turn of the 20th century, when photo reproduction technology got better. For example, the Pinkertons put out several posters of the members of the Wild Bunch, complete with pictures. Some lawmen carried photos made of criminals when they were in prison. The backs of these mugshots feature descriptions that included height, weight, hair and eye color, scars and identifying marks. But these were put together by hand and the photos were originals, not prints. I've seen these saddlebag circulars and they are amazing. You can see the seeds of the later wanted posters that we think of when we watch Western movies. Authorities rarely placed wanted posters in public places. A reward or wanted notice would occasionally be printed in a newspaper. But for the most part, they were not intended for general consumption. When a card or letter did result in a successful apprehension, the arresting officer shared the reward money with the lawman who had sent the card in the first place. I've read that Sheriff John Behan was a scoundrel in Tombstone during the trouble years. Is that the case? Chuck Sawyer, Phoenix, Arizona. I've never been a big fan of John Harris Behan, mainly because of his role in the Cochise County War. But he was an interesting character. Like his nemesis, Wyatt Earp, he came west as a young man. He joined the California Column during the Civil War and fought with the Union volunteers at Apache Pass in 1862. A year later, he was in Tucson as a freighter before he moved up to the Prescott area, where he was a bullwhacker, prospector, and Indian fighter. In early 1866, he and some friends were out prospecting when a band of about 30 Yavapai jumped them. They managed to fight their way out of that one. When Behan became undersheriff in Yavapai County, he joined numerous Indian fighting expeditions. The Prescott Journal Miner called him brave and intelligent. In 1871-72, during the height of the Indian Wars in the area, he served as county sheriff. Arizona was pretty wild, and a man had to have bark to be a lawman. That was Behan's life prior to his checkered career as sheriff of Cochise County. Then he got into territorial politics with the legislature. Maybe that's where he learned his bad habits. Sometime around 1879, he moved to Tombstone and became involved in that mining town's crazy politics. I can't help but wonder if he and Wyatt might have gotten along had one been a Republican and the other a Democrat. Who actually shot the coin tossed in the air in the movie Winchester 73? Steve Andrews, Colorado Springs, Colorado. I ran this by True West's gun expert, Phil Sperringberger, and we both agreed that the shooter was Herb Parsons, a marksman employed by Winchester Arms. Daniel Brumley, curatorial assistant at the Cody Firearms Museum at the Buffalo Bill Historical Center, confirms Parsons was the shooter. He says Parsons is standing in the scene when Jimmy Stewart shoots the coin. Check it out the next time you see the film. By the way, the rifle Parsons used in that shot, a model 71 Winchester chambered for .348 caliber, is on display at the Buffalo Bill Historical Center, signed by the cast, and the coin is embedded in the stock. What do you know about a bank holdup in Hatch, New Mexico? Tinkborough's Silver City, New Mexico. I believe you're referring to the holdup by 32-year-old Gideon L. Redding, who, on June 1, 1932, rode into town on a black horse and robbed the First National Bank of $2,000. He placed adhesive tape across his face to conceal his identity. Lawmen arrested him 8 days later as he was milking a cow at a ranch in Big Lake, Texas, east of Cambrai, New Mexico. He told friends that he needed the money to pay off some debts. You could call Redding the last of the horseback bank robbers. For a cowboy, he was pretty talkative. Texas writer Paul Patterson, who did trail time with Redding, said seven lawyers defended the robber, but Redding did most of the talking. The whole experience must not have been too bad. Redding died in 1993,